runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Carl Franklin introducing show number 36 with Kim Tripp and Paul Randall, recorded Friday, November 16th, 2007. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, offering professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com.
Hi, this is Richard Campbell. You're listening to Run As Radio. We're here on the last day of TechEd. Guys,
goodness,
Greg, say something.
It's been a long week.
Yeah, it's been a long week. It's been a long week for you two, yo-yo.
It just started.
I think we're going to have to leave the whole warm up to this in just to give the folks an impression. We're sitting here with Kim Tripp and Paul Randall, and you're doing 12 sessions this week.
We have actually done 11. We just finished our 11th session, although not all of them were breakouts. We did 3 breakout sessions. 4 ILLs. Our last ILL is today. We did a demo session, a fast-paced demo session, and then we did we did 2 or 3 chalk talks.
And a partridge and a pear.
Yeah. It feels like that, actually.
Well, you guys have been really busy. As usual, actually. You never go to a conference lightly.
No, that's actually true. I don't know why, but it's like they keep asking me, hey, do you want to add on another demo session? I'm like, sure. I don't really do the math.
It's because you're a celebrity.
Yeah. Oh.
Well, if you're going to be.
Actually, I think it's the blonde hair. I think that's actually the problem more than anything.
My fame will just have its trials
all right,
and tribulations.
Stop. Move on.
Okay.
Move on.
Okay.
No, I'm still having fun. I think that's part of the problem and the benefit. I mean,
we wouldn't do it if we weren't having fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, the two of you are crazy together too. I mean, it's just taking the whole thing to another level. As an attendee and a viewer of the in the audience, it's just been madness when the both of you are on there.
You know, actually, I have to make a joke about this because today we did a session together and. We rehearsed, of course, but not real formally. We don't do real formal presentations and rehearsals. But at one point, I was going through SQL 2008's DMF, Declarative Management Framework, and I was showing some policies that I had enabled on some databases, and I had restored a SQL 2005 database that was actually originally a SQL 2000 database, so it had a database page verification setting to torn page detection. Well, there's a policy that you can set in the DMF that says your databases have to have a checksum instead of torn page. And Paul can definitely go into all the nitty-gritty details on why this is so much better if you guys want to talk about that. But the point was I was specifically demoing what happens after a policy is checked. And what happens is they'll actually mark the database with a little tiny error. And then up the chain, just like the replication monitor that we have today,
right.
And you'll actually see all the way up the chain this little error. And I'm demoing specifically talking about the error. And Paul was doing something completely different. And he looked over and he goes, what's that little icon that is there? And I'm just kind of standing there on stage and the whole audience is like, that's actually what she's talking about,
yeah.
Paul?
Where have you been?
Yeah, where have you been? I mean, I know you're standing right next to her there, but apparently you're not really there. It's the looks alive, but the not is alive. So yeah, I said to Paul, I guess you weren't listening, dear. So yeah, we're having a good time. We're speaking together on a lot of topics and bouncing things off of each other. And, you know, they have a bunch of sessions where they've just listed me and I drag him on stage and they just list him and he drags me on stage. And I think out of the 12 sessions, there was only one session of each that we weren't actually very actively co-presenting.
Right. So speaking of SQL Server 2008, I mean, we have the god and goddess of SQL Server sitting with us here. So,
where?
I know.
Yeah, where are they?
So, what's coming up in SQL Server 2008? What do IT professionals need to know about?
Well, I can start with the DMF. I mean, I just to continue on that same,
sure.
same line. So the Declarative Management Framework is really building on some of the past features that we've used and leveraged a lot, like BPA, the Best Practices Analyzer. The SQL surface area configuration tool and the agent. So if you think of all of the policies that you have enforced by going to the SQL surface area configuration tool, checked it, and then basically set it so that it wasn't enabled, or at least verified that it was or wasn't enabled, or you've run BPA, which unfortunately is a separate download, but when you've run it, you've been able to check some of the best practices that, you know, you should be adhering to in the environment, right? So my point is, they've taken these best practices, they've taken the SQL surface area configuration tool, and they've taken those policies and put them into this thing called the DMF, where you can actually go to some of these best practices, like don't run auto shrink. And that could start off.
Evil.
Yeah,
evil.
Auto shrink is evil. But you could basically take the auto shrink database property and say that that should be false. You can then target it at a server or even a group of servers for that matter. And you can have the DMF check to see if the servers are set, generate errors if they're not. And you can even enforce the policy, on demand. You can actually click and say, enforce this now. And it'll go out and actually change all of the databases to the correct setting.
Across even a farm of servers, it sounds like you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can take in the registered servers dialog, a group of servers, manage them as a unit, and the agent jobs can actually get set up on all the different servers.
So what does that mean in the real world? I mean, what sucks about previous versions of SQL Server that this really solves? What's the pain that was being addressed?
Yeah, I think it's not that anything sucks per se, although, you know, database shrink sucks, and auto close sucks, and not having checks up.
Yeah.
Okay, but it's not, you know, now that you don't work for Microsoft, you're way too.
I can say whatever I like.
No, it's not, you know, I can't believe that I'm being more politically correct than you these days. That's pretty scary. My point, though, is there were some things in previous releases that were set for, I don't know if I'd say the wrong reasons, but like on lower-end editions of SQL Server, like Express or Workgroup, there were some even default settings, like in Express, that were auto-shrink, auto-close, and a lot of developers will develop on a lower-end system, backup, restore, and those settings end up getting propagated all the way up into production and sometimes the enterprise.
Right.
And the end result of that is, it might have been fine for a development environment, but it's absolutely abysmal.
It's a
in production.
Pretty optimistic way of setting things at a lower level if you're really going to have to spread it up to something that has to scale.
Yeah, and not everybody knows all of, exactly, and nobody knows all of the options at the time they're developing, or even by the time they go into production, depending on what their background is, they might not know all of these best practices. So bringing them all together in one single central place with recommended settings, because that's even, it's not just how do you want to set this, it's this is how we recommend that it's set. Literally, to enforce these policies, you enable it, set a schedule, and you're done. I mean, it really is rather simple. So I like that aspect of it.
I'm thinking from a consultant's point of view, the ability to go in and look at somebody else's database and take your policy set with you and say, okay, how do these policies apply to their database?
Yeah, absolutely. You can even add your own custom policies as well. And in the future, they're hopefully going to make it even more extensible, where you can do kind of more generic even. I want to try to enforce a maximum amount of downtime or data loss of X minutes. And then all of the things that are impacted by that kind of a problem.
Right.
And it's amazing when you really think about it, but it's not there yet.
No.
But I mean, as far as
you could see a day, you know, how many times have we battled this? We go into the whiteboard, you go into the war room of a company, and the VP there says, we need 100% uptime. And my immediate goal is to say, all right, here's 99% uptime, here's 100% uptime, here's the differences, here's the price difference. I go there first, just from experience.
Yeah.
But to have a tool that would help you, all right, let's look at your current configuration. This is the expected uptime with this configuration. Now, 100% looks like this. Here's all the things we're missing. Once again, we get back to, here's the price of your, I want 100% uptime.
Yeah, absolutely. We're a little bit away from that, but I think that's incredible.
Oh, so I still have a job. Is that
you
what
you still
telling
have
me?
A job, my friend. You still have a job.
So speaking of 100% uptime, and I mentioned earlier that, you know, some things in previous versions suck. One of the things that sucks was around peer-to-peer replication. Peer-to-peer replication was put into SQL Server 2005, and it's a way of being able to scale out your workload across various nodes.
Right.
And once you've defined your peer-to-peer topology and it's all running, this is all very cool, right? Until you want to add another node. If you want to add another node to your peer-to-peer topology, you have to quiesce the entire thing. All the databases in the entire topology, no activity at all. So you're down. Then you can add another node, then you can bring it all back up again.
That doesn't seem acceptable. I mean, obviously, anybody who needs this feature in the first place is so busy, one set of servers couldn't hack it.
Well, okay. So Yes and no. To a certain extent, peer-to-peer is more about scalability than availability. So I could argue that in a lot of implementations, they're going for the scale out, not the availability side. But I
you're
agree.
Right. She is more politically correct than she is.
I know. I know. I swear. But seriously, though, I'm
in recovery from Microsoft. Yeah.
You know how, when you recently quit smoking, you're sort of against all smokers all of a sudden? He's swung the other way. He's gone mad.
Yeah. Anyway, so in 2008, they've actually fixed that problem. So you can actually remove nodes to a peer-to-peer topology on the fly.
Live,
without having to quiesce anything, which is fantastic.
And they've actually made the management of the topology a lot easier in SQL 2008 as well, in terms of having a kind of a topology viewer and even a graphical way of adding nodes essentially into the peer-to-peer topology. So they've, in terms of manageability, that's the session that we just did. So we happen to be kind of on a high for manageability. But, in terms of a lot of the features, they've made a lot of them more easily manageable, like peer-to-peer. We talked actually about some other features like the performance collector and the data warehouse capability. And in 2005, we have the ability with DMVs to persist information that is related to like query statistics, index usage statistics, missing indexes.
Right.
And
we're talking dynamic management views.
Yeah,
here.
The DMVs. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And the negative part with the DMVs is that the data isn't persisted for the life of the server, right? I mean, each DMV has a different kind of persistence model, and when it goes away. And in some cases, like in the index usage stats, that's a great example. Every time your database is effectively closed in any way, shape, or form, you lose all your DMV information about usage stats. So if the server bounces, you lose all your index usage stats. If you close, detach, move a database, restore, you lose everything about the statistics about that database's usage for indexes. So my point is, a lot of people are coming up with their own algorithms and deciding that they want to persist this data. And there's a lot of different ways to do it and different strategies. And while doing that on your own is possible, in 2008, they've added something called the Performance Data Collector. And it, by default, will gather some things for you and even set up the automated jobs to collect them every, let's say, 15 minutes and persist the data for up to 14 days. And then they have some default reports that are possible so that you can actually go into a certain time frame and find the different blips per se of activity and kind of zoom in and start to find the expensive queries and queries by CPU, queries by duration, queries that are missing indexes, and all sorts of stuff.
The biggest thing I'd want to look at with that kind of persisted data is comparing before and afters of changes of configuration. I go and add my new indexes and I've got my old DMVs that I've saved from yesterday before I made those changes. Now I let it run for a couple of days and then compare up.
So one of the things that they will do if they have enough history in terms of query plan history is they will actually show you multiple query plans, and they will keep for each of the different query plans the query statistics that tell you the execution duration, reads and writes. So depending on how much information they've got and how many times you've collected the information, you will be able to see a particular query over a particular period of time and what the execution plans were and how they differ. So yeah, that actually is possible.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing here is correlate that same query with whenever you've generated different query plans and say, well, here's the four different kinds of plans and how many times they were used and the distinctions of them.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
That's pretty exciting, actually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a very good idea.
No, I agree.
All right, new feature. 2008. Yeah. Your turn, Paul.
She concentrates on the tools. I like the damn dirty engine stuff. So for me,
you are the old storage engine guy.
I like the engine stuff too. That's not fair.
Well, I don't like the tool stuff. I can't say that, can I?
Actually, in the last session, just to make you laugh even more, Paul was showing a few things and he brought up Notepad to actually go and read the error log.
It works.
So I have to give him a little bit of grief on this because there is the log viewer now in SQL 2005, which actually allows you to search and filter on things like error. But what's interesting and maybe one of the still useful reasons of going back to tools like Notepad is that when you filter, sometimes you'll only get the header and not the actual message because each header and error message are separated to a separate line.
Right.
So it's kind of, to be honest, I like the log file viewer, but I'm hoping we see a few changes there.
It needs to be a little smarter. It needs to be able to relate those lines.
So sometimes you kind of have to go back to the root tools and even grab a tool like Notepad.
Don't you hate it when the guy is right?
Now, wait a minute here.
What?
I don't hate it when the guy is right. I have no problem with the guy being right. It's just that I am usually
right,
not
right.
the guy, and I am usually right. They made me say that.
She is usually right. Yeah.
Oh, that's a good answer.
Yes. I have to say that because I'm married to her.
So very married. Yes.
Okay, so for me, the most exciting thing, I think, is compression that's been put into SQL Server 2008.
Really?
There's three kinds of compression that's been put in. The first kind is data compression. So one of the major roadblocks to people being able to migrate from, say, Oracle or IBM to SQL Server is the fact that on Oracle and IBM, they have data compression. And so, you know, consider something like a 1 terabyte compressed database in one of these other systems. You move it over to SQL Server, and it might expand out to 5 or 6 terabytes.
Right.
Now, the cost of having to manage that storage is kind of prohibitive.
It's huge.
Yeah, so that's been a major roadblock. So now there's row and page compression in SQL Server 2008, and the actual compression rate is comparable to those of other systems as well. What's cool about it is you can define different kinds of compression features on different partitions. So it's not just at a per table level. You can actually go down to the partition granularity. There's a tool that you can use to estimate compression ratios before you actually turn it on. Because the way you turn it on is you set compression on and you have to rebuild your indexes, which is a kind of expensive operation. So you want to know that you're going to get all the benefits from it before you actually turn it on. And even the DMV sys.dmdb index physical stats has been upgraded to keep track of the ongoing compression ratio of indexes once it is turned on. So that's the first type. Second type is backup compression. At last, backup compression is native in 2008. So backup compression, a lot of people have used things like Lightspeed, but if you use Lightspeed, you've got to pay for another license. Yep. And some companies, they don't allow anything but Microsoft software in their IT shops, which is means they can't use Lightspeed. So by having backup compression inside SQL Server 2008, you've got it native in the product, you don't have to buy another license, and it's actually on by default, I just discovered today. It was supposed to be on by off by default, and they changed the behavior to be on by default now. So it's pretty transparent, okay? The backup and restore commands both know exactly what to do. It means that if you compress your backups now, then obviously it takes less storage space. They're easier to move around because they're smaller. It's faster to do the backup, and it's also faster to do the restore, which I love, because in a disaster recovery situation, the restore time is probably the major component in getting yourself back up and running. So the faster the restore time, the less downtime you're going to have to take in a disaster.
As an IT guy, one of the pains in the past of going from one version of SQL Server to another has to do with backwards compatibility and performance of the new version in a backwards compatible mode. What's it look like going from a SQL 2000 to 2008 and 2005 to 2008 from a performance standpoint now?
Well, I mean, the first thing that I'll say is they usually don't do all of their intense performance testing until all the code is baked for the most part.
Sure.
So I haven't seen any major performance differences or deltas between the different releases. Hopefully that's about now when that'll start being done, because even today they're releasing the next CTP of SQL 2008.
Yeah, it's imminent, isn't it? The next couple of days.
Yeah, in fact, they announced yesterday that it was going to be today, so
oh, okay.
At least to some internal groups. But I don't know if that'll exactly play out to be today, but end of November, basically, we're looking at the next CTP.
Right, so by the time the show is aired, we should see the next community tech preview of SQL 2008.
Yeah. And one thing that I would say is it's really nice that you can take a database directly, backup, restore it from SQL 2000 to 2008, 2005 to 2008. I've already been doing that now.
Right.
But it is true, and we saw this a lot in SQL 2000 to 2005 migrations, that sometimes the query plans weren't the same.
Right.
One of the biggest factors was like updating statistics on the update. And you're still going to want to do things like that when you upgrade. But, you know, I haven't seen anything directly, and I haven't even personally done any. To be honest, I don't do a lot of performance testing until more code is baked, because then you want to see how the features react.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So actually, it's interesting, because one of the things where when you do an upgrade, you are going to see a transparent increase in performance is the third kind of compression, which is log stream compression in database mirroring.
Oh, right.
If you have a workload that generates so much transaction log that the network bandwidth you have available means that you can't efficiently send the log over the network to the mirror. When you upgrade to 2008, the log stream will actually be transparently compressed on the principal before it's sent over to the mirror. So reducing the amount of network bandwidth you need and consequently increasing your transaction throughput and your workload performance.
And you're just trading processor work for network work.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, all the things that I've said, there's obviously a trade-off between the amount of CPU you use to do the compression compression and the extra performance or compression that you get, for instance. So,
jumping back to the data compression, because of course I'm always fascinated by that. Is it only via partitioning that I would be able to specify a particular column to compress, or can
no,
I actually?
Absolutely not. No, you can specify table level, index level, and partition level compression.
So pretty much any angle I can go in and decide what I want to compress.
Yep.
There's two forms of compression as well. There's basically what's called row level compression and page level compression, and each one has different pros and cons. And there's actually been some great resources already written on SQL 2008. Paul and I have been blogging about it, and this is exactly what we're targeting doing over the next few weeks and months, is starting to really get into the costs of the CPU that factors in. But the good news is when you're processing less pages and you're using less cache and you're able to have smaller indexes, even though you're paying a penalty in terms of CPU, most people aren't CPU bound. They're memory bound, they're disk bound, and at that point, you're getting some significant gains, even though you are paying for the CPU cost. So
I wonder if the query processor is actually going to be smart enough to realize that an index, even though it's smaller, is actually compressed, so there's going to be extra CPU involved in decompressing the compressed pages before they can actually be
right. The
used.
Query plan's got to be modified to assess the cost of the decompression.
So there's probably something in the optimizer, I haven't looked into this at all, that would basically look at an index, assess the usefulness of the index, and add into the cost of utilization the cost of compression.
I think it would be fascinating to get to a point in a query where you could see, I'll use this index if it's not compressed and not use it if it's not compressed.
Yeah, absolutely. I know Sunil, who did some discussions, talked about the relative cost of a particular step if that step was on compressed data. And again, because it's smaller, that can sometimes be significantly
reduced. Well, we already know this happens sometimes. There are cases where the query processor realizes, I'm not going to get any advantage going to this index.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'm just going to go grab the table.
Don't get us started on indexes.
Oh, don't say the I word.
I'll behave.
Okay. So we talked.
You know, there's new features in indexes in SQL 2008.
Why don't we go there?
actually, this isn't something we talked about today, but SQL 2008 is going to have some new features around indexes, something called a filtered index. And what that's going to give you the ability to do is effectively create an index on a certain set of data rather than the entire table. Right? Today, every index has one entry for every row
right.
of the table in the leaf level of the index.
Wouldn't I do this with indexing on a view?
So, today, you can create an index over a view, and the view could be on a subset of data, absolutely.
Right.
But you have to be using the Enterprise Edition. Oh, I'm not sure if filtered indexes are going to be in the Enterprise only. Do you know?
I don't think those decisions have been made yet.
Yeah. So this is a good question, right? But indexed views historically have been only in the Enterprise, at least fully functional in the Enterprise
right.
Edition. You could leverage them if you only access the view and you used hints in earlier editions.
Yeah,
or not
you had to use
smaller
the view.
Editions, yeah.
I mean, it's the advantage of doing a filtered index on the table is now you can continue to query the table, and if it finds a case where it makes sense to use the filtered index, it'll use it.
Yeah, and the other thing that's really cool is you could end up saying, I want to filter this particular set of data or
right.
create an index over this particular set of data or where the data is not null, because you might only need to do your point queries on the not null values. And if the majority of data is null, then having an index that has, you know, 80% of its data null is wasted space.
Well,
yeah.
This is also seems like another opportunity to delay archiving, that I could leave my sales data in place for a year, but put additional indexes on the current month.
Yeah, or you know, even add some indexes over some of the more active data over the historical data and less indexes over the, you know, OLTP portion.
Right,
and then
the transactionally speed-sensitive data.
Exactly. And that's also the beauty with partitioning, or not partitioning, with compression that Paul mentioned and partitioning, because you could take the active stuff, and if you're finding too much of a CPU hit, you could actually make the active partition not compressed and the really old data compressed to save space.
You know what I was just thinking, Richard? They should do their own show.
No, none of that. They are awful good with a microphone, though, aren't they?
Okay, so we've been alluding to that for a little while, so we are looking at that option and possibility.
Well, I think
so.
It'd be great. Certainly there's a need for really smart people providing great information about SQL Server.
Do you have anybody in mind
yeah,
that could do that?
Yeah, who would do that?
All right, you two. Have we missed any major features on the management side?
Transparent data encryption. This is very cool.
Yes.
So in SQL Server 2005, you could put on column-level encryption, but you had to encrypt each column individually. Once a column is encrypted, you can't define an index over it, for instance, and you can't encrypt all data types. With SQL Server 2008, you can say, I want this database to be completely encrypted, and it's encrypted on disk, totally transparently. The application doesn't have to change at all. So when the pages are in memory, they're decrypted. When they're written out from the buffer pool, they're encrypted. What that means is if somebody, say, detaches the database or leaves a laptop lying around with a database on it, the database is encrypted. So no more loss of, like, social security numbers by their thousands.
Right. I can see from, a PCI compliance standpoint that could be really valuable. Also allow application writers to use encryption in the database, or maybe they've had to skip doing encryption before in order to get the proper performance out of the database server that they need for their high availability application.
Yep.
That's terrific.
And it significantly reduces the complexity of the application, because column-level encryption requires a lot of additional application intelligence to really do it well.
And yeah, this is getting rid of the coding side of using encryption in the database.
Yeah, I mean, it's protecting the database and even in a backup. I mean, a lot of people have asked me, well, they have backup compression, do they have backup encryption? And the answer is yes and no. I mean, they don't have it directly where you can say backup, compress it, and encrypt it. But if your database is encrypted using transparent data encryption,
right,
then when you back it up, it will also be encrypted. So that gives you double protection.
I can't count in my mind the number of architecture discussions I've had with software teams who are building, really high availability and highly scalable web applications on SQL Server that do a great job, but the encryption, because you don't have transparent encryption, this is great, really has been the limiting factor in terms of being able to do the proper job of securing data on disk.
Yeah, absolutely. And one other thing about transparent data encryption is you can choose to have the backup of that database maintain the encryption. So you can actually take an encrypted backup of the database. Now, you can't have a database that's not encrypted and have a backup that is encrypted.
Sure.
So backup encryption isn't there. Oh, I wasn't listening.
No, I
wasn't listening to you.
Well, that's really sad.
I was watching Richard.
Just said exactly.
No, Richard's prettier than you. I was watching him. Sorry. Actually, after 11 seconds.
You are so in trouble. Let's just put it that way. When this mic is off.
But I mean, you bring up one salient point there, which was the database must be encrypted to have a backup that's encrypted.
Correct. Yeah, and you can choose to not have it encrypted as well.
He was watching Paul. He's so pretty.
I'm getting scared by these two looking across the table at each other.
We're all speechless.
Yeah.
And where do we go from here?
Rudy, poor Greg.
We're just about out of time, Richard. So, is there anything else you want to wrap up with? From the perspective of the guy who installs, manages, and runs SQL Server in the IT department, what else do they need to know?
So as far as I think the biggest feature, the one I started with, really, DMF, I see that as probably one of the most exciting, simplified ways to manage a large number of servers with policy-based administration, which is just so much easier to manage.
Yeah, it's great to hear the word policy associated with SQL Server in general instead of property.
Yeah, exactly.
It's usually the way we've had to think about it. So
most of the time we're just looking, right?
Yeah.
We're not really enforcing policies. And now you can literally check, you can periodically recheck, and you can even enforce.
Yeah,
so
I think that's very compelling. Ship date? Did we have official ship date yet? I know we're getting a CTP at the end of the month.
Well, SQL 2009 should be out any... No, I'm totally kidding.
Nice.
Totally kidding. The party line has always been second quarter in the calendar year of 2008.
Right.
To be honest, I don't see too many of my customers go into production on the RTM release of any product.
Right.
And I really wouldn't hold my breath on releasing, let's say, in second quarter on, let's say, whatever the first month is, April 1st, right? I wouldn't expect that.
No.
Would I expect June 45th or so? Probably more likely. And I'm not trying to, it just takes a long time to bake a product like this. I mean,
And it's SQL Server. It must be right,
Right? So I'm always, a lot of people get really irate when there's slips and there's slips and there's slips. And, I've written a lot of stuff, white papers that I've had to rewrite when things change, and it's irritating. It's all, but it's part of life. It's protecting our data.
Yeah. In the case of SQL Server, it must be right more than on time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I expect it in the second quarter,
right,
or very close to it. And, I'm really encouraging a lot of my customers to start actively participating in CTPs and starting to get involved with a lot of the blogs that people are writing. There's a ton of us blogging on 2008 already,
yes,
and white papers that are getting written. So there's a lot of great resources out there to start learning, start becoming aware, and start even doing some testing.
Awesome. We've been talking to Kim Tripp and Paul Randall. Any last words, Paul?
I'm very tired.
Yeah. One session. What's the session you've got left to go?
So we have an ILL, an instructor-led lab, which is actually a repeat of our database mirroring lab. And it's 75 minutes, and we basically go through.
You're not still pulling the USB keys out of the book.
No, not for database mirroring, no. But, yeah, I still do that demo occasionally. But, yeah, this one is we set up a database mirroring partnership in the synchronous mirroring model with a witness. We do some failovers. We do application transparency. Parent client redirect. We do a WMI based alert. We send email based on the failover scenario. So we kind of go through monitoring, alerts, management, setup, and it's quite a fun lab, actually. It's one of my favorites.
Cool. All right. Kim Tripp, Paul Randall, thanks very much for coming and talking to us.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Once again, Richard.
As always. And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.